Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 35. I'm Mark, and this week I'm talking about what happened when I plugged a phone into my TV.
Hi, I'm Martin, and I'm revisiting some of Mark's greatest hits from past episodes of Linux Matters that have changed my life.
Hello, I'm Alan, and I contributed.
So, Alan, it turns out our friend Mark was right.
Uh-oh.
Twice.
It's about time.
Only twice, though.
Well, I'm going to visit two occasions that Mark was right. I am sure there are many others. I'm going to take us all the way back to episode 3, initially, where Mark talked about finding note-taking nirvana with an app called Joplin. And at that time, you and I, Alan, had both recently started new jobs, and we had been using Notion. And I think we'd both moved our own personal note-taking stuff into Notion as a result of being impressed with using Notion for work.
Spoiler, I've moved twice since then.
Well, here we go. I have moved from Notion to Joplin.
Yes.
Why?
Well, the telltale sign that your note-taking solution isn't working for you had manifested with a scattershot of markdown files in my documents folder, and I was just choosing to open a basic text editor and start recording just scratch notes and things in that rather than open Notion in a web browser and deal with all of its complexity when I just wanted to do a very simple thing.
Okay, so I'm a little way behind you. I'm now at the dump the rich text editor. I'm now back to using Sublime Text.
Right.
And I'm editing markdown files that are sat in my sync thing folder.
Right. So I went back and listened to the episode where Mark talked about Joplin, and I thought, right, I'm going to get this and give it a go. One of the things that attracted me is that Joplin has a desktop app. So it is an editor, and it is just a markdown editor. It's utterly uncomplicated, which is what I wanted. So having just played with it for a few moments, I thought, right, I'm sticking with this. And I was like, right, how do I get all my stuff out of Notion? Well, thankfully, someone has written a little Python script called Notion to Joplin.
Handy.
So also, helpfully, Notion don't put any restrictions on you moving your data around. So either individual documents or groups, folders, or the whole thing, you can export. So you do that, you export everything from Notion. And once you've got that, I think it's a zip file, some sort of archive, you then run this Notion to Joplin, which does a little bit of conversion and strips out some of the Notion stuff. And then you've got a folder that you can then go to Joplin and say, import this folder, and all of the stuff gets imported.
And are you just using vanilla Joplin with its out-of-the-box features, or have you added any plugins as well?
I am just using vanilla Joplin. The only additional thing I've configured is I've connected its sync service to my Dropbox account, and I have the Joplin app on my phone, because some of the notes I've got are things like recipes, and I just want to be able to reference those when I'm cooking. I don't use it for my shopping list or anything. Now, I was still concerned that Joplin may be a bit heavyweight and over the top. And thankfully, Chris Downing in our Telegram channel, which you can join at linuxmatters.sh/telegram, suggested an application called Haynote. And that is ace. It is a single file scratchpad markdown. And that's all it is. It's a single window, single file, but multiple blocks. So you can create a block for a to-do list for your household stuff, a block for your to-do list for work, code highlighting. So if you're just putting together snippets, it's absolutely great.
What do you mean by block?
You kind of have to see it to understand it. So if you imagine line numbers in a text editor, and you have the first few lines 1 to 10, and that could be a bit of markdown, you can hit Control Enter, and it creates a new block and color codes it, and the line number starts at 1 in that block. And you can choose a different syntax highlighter or capability for that block. And then you can keep a different set of notes in a different context in that block.
So like pages?
like Pages, but in one file.
Continuous Pages.
Yeah,
right.
One continuous file.
Got it.
And it's available for Mac, Windows, and Linux, and it's really elegant. I think it's great. So that is permanently open.
This is Haynote.
It's called Haynote.
Right.
I'll have a link in the show notes. And I have that open all of the time. And quite often what happens now is when I'm researching something, I compose my notes in Haynote. And when I've got everything organized, it's just a copy paste and drop it into Joplin for sort of my persistent store.
What's the next grandfather on from where'd you put the markdown after that, after Joplin?
That's it. Joplin is the end place because that is the searchable place where I then organize it and tag it and all that sort of thing. So I can find things in the future, like the coordinates of the hole that the washing line goes in the back garden.
Okay.
So there we go. Joplin and Haynote. Thank you very much, Mark, for telling us about Joplin. That has changed my life. I also now have note-taking nirvana.
So how else was I right?
Oh, God, don't milk it.
On this occasion, you were half right. You talked about, in episode 2, your LG Joule Up display, a large, well, how do we describe it?
It's just a big monitor.
It's a PC monitor, yeah, and it's 2560 by 2880. And the reason that you were half right is because I've got two of them. So I have a quad up. It's what I think I've created. So a couple of weekends ago, one of my monitors flat out died, dead kaput. The electrics have completely gone. And when you told us about this monitor a year ago, I was really taken with it as an idea. And I was like, right, this is an opportunity. So my wife has got the outgoing monitor that didn't die, and I now have two of these, and they are amazing. These displays are properly excellent.
How have you got them connected? Because there's a few options for connecting them, but the sort of the primary one is a USB-C plug, which I guess most devices won't let you connect to USB-C displays at the same time, I would imagine.
Well, here we go. So I have got both of these connected over DisplayPort to my PC.
Okay.
And then that connectivity that's round the back has USB-C cable, and it has HDMI, and it has USB for sort of connecting up its USB hub.
Yeah.
And that USB cable can be used to connect, say, a laptop to, to use it as a second display. And so that's what I'm doing.
Second and third display.
Right, this is it. So I am using the USB cable as a means to plug a laptop into it, because it also provides 90 watts of charge power. So you can plug a laptop in and just charge it, or you can plug a laptop in and it's got a picture-by-picture mode. And so then it will, on one of the monitors, chop one half of the screen off and give that to the laptop as a second display. And this is just fabulous. I can see that this is going to completely change the utility of my laptops at home. I'm going to be far more likely to get them out and plug them in and use them now.
So just to clarify, so then what your desktop has is one full Joule Up display as display one, and then half a Joule Up display, which is essentially a 1440p monitor, as display two, and then your laptop has the other half of that Joule Up as its external display.
Only when I have a laptop connected.
Yes.
So it has both Joule Up displays connected to the PC at all times, but when I plug a laptop in, the screen wakes up and says, oh, you've plugged something in, would you like to activate it? And then it breaks them in half.
And is your desktop happy with that just suddenly happening?
Yeah, in fact, that's something that's worth pointing out. If you go and look at YouTube for reviews of these Joule Ups, they were mostly reviewed by owners of Macs, and they all lament they can't actually get the exact resolution of the display working on Mac OS. There is a way to do it, but they, you know, these reviewers didn't figure it out.
Keep it light, keep it positive.
But on Linux, it just detects both of these screens at the right resolution. I didn't have any effort. Even like the boot screens and Plymouth and all of that stuff just works. And yeah, when you break a screen by saying picture in picture mode, it just dynamically reshuffles the display manager, resizes the windows on the screen that just got lopped in half. It's not caused any problems at all. It's been absolutely amazing. So the Linux support is really good.
I would expect that to happen. I would expect it to have taken away a display or half the display or resize the display and then tell EDID or whatever it does down the cable, this resolution is no longer the resolution you thought it is. It's now a different resolution. And if you do that normally with a monitor, like rotate it or unplug it, Linux is these days much better than Windows and Mac OS at like determining what to do with new pixels and pixels that have disappeared.
Yeah, so adding and removing displays is fine. I was just amazed that actually taking a display and changing its resolution just out of the blue was a fine and handled capability. Anyway, it's terrific. So that's all good. I suppose because these are slightly portrait, but they are large, it's a 28-inch screen, and I have two of them side by side, and I have them arranged side by side with a little gap down the middle, and I have the camera lens of my camera poking through the middle at me now. So this is altogether an improvement in my desk ergonomics. If you look at anything that's like a document or a web page or coding on these things, it is a joy to behold. Quite often when you go to websites, the whole web page loads and is visible in the display. Some people have said that, you know, watch it is not ideal for YouTube. I think it's great for YouTube because now you get a full half screen at the top for the video, and then you get all the comments and thumbnails beneath, and there's quite a lot of space.
Some would say that that's not ideal.
Well,
you should make it full screen on one of the halves of one of the displays.
Right.
And then you got like 1440, you know, on one half of one display, and you can keep using the rest of it. But ain't got no time for comments.
Some other notable apps that work really well on this. I'm learning Blender with my daughter. Running Blender on this display is outstanding because you can just see so much stuff and get so many of the tools and widgets on screen. It completely changes the usability of Blender. And the same for DaVinci Resolve, which is a video editor, which opens in a full screen. It has no window controls. It just opens full screen on whatever monitor you want it on. Mm-hmm. And now you get all of the sort of editing features in the top half of the screen. You can compose the way it's laid out. So you now have the timeline in the bottom and then all of the editing features at the top.
So this was two dual up monitors.
Yeah.
And each of those monitors is 2650 by 1440 on top of another one. So 2880.
Yes.
Vertically. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Come on then. How much?
What cost?
Yeah.
So if you join LG members program, they give you a discount. So they were already discounted down to £465 from their original 550, I think. But if you join their member program, you get a 20% off for a two-item multi-buy. And I got a 5% discount for my first purchase. I got a 25% discount on that. So the pair were £800.
Wow.
Which is only slightly more than one of the monitors that I bought 8 years ago.
So I'm just noodling on everyone's least favorite online retailer. And one standard 2560 by 1440 MSI curved monitor is about £160.
Yeah.
So if you buy four of those, that's £640. And then you can buy a monitor stand that will take all four of them.
Right.
Probably want to spend a bit more than £40 for that. Mm-hmm. So approaching the same kind of price, but right. You have more features on that and you would have less bezels, although you have got extra bezel because you've got a gap between them.
Yeah. And these come with their own fully articulated arm.
The arm is fantastic.
Ah.
The arm is excellent. Very quickly, these are amazing for retro gaming, which is something I care about, particularly vertical scrolling games like arcade games from the 80s and 90s. Out of this world. It's like made for it.
So you've got loads and loads and loads of pixels and you're drawing 320 of them across the screen and 160 of them down the screen or something like that.
Yeah, but when you've got all of the like CRT scanline shaders going, I mean, it looks just absolutely peach. It's really good. But here's the one drawback. I think my love affair with Pantheon Desktop may be at a close.
Oh.
Because with this aspect, it doesn't like how to split applications. So I want to split things now top to bottom, and there's no facility for that at all in Pantheon. I'm sure I could contribute that if I was highly motivated enough. But what I've decided is maybe this is my opportunity to go and investigate some of those new fancy tiling Wayland desktop options that have got window rules and things like that. So I'm going to go away and have a little experiment with those and report back.
I have been contributing, and the way I have been contributing is by helping other distros.
What have you been helping them do?
So last week, we put out a new release at work of a couple of bits of software. SIFT, which is a thing that generates software bill of materials, SBOMs, from like containers. So you point it at a Docker container and it tells you what's inside it. And there's another piece of software called Gripe that tells you what vulnerabilities and what's wrong with what's inside it. And these two pieces of software get updated on a regular basis, and they got updated. And we build binaries and we put them in GitHub, and there's all the sensible ways to install them that we provide. But obviously, other distros have their own way to supply software, and they package them in new and interesting and old and interesting and different ways. And it struck me that I didn't know off the top of my head, like, how up to date all those other distros were. Like, we've just put out a release. I wonder what the rest of the Linux ecosystem looks like. And I've never really used it, but there is a website called Repology, R-E-P-O-L-O-G-Y, or something like that. And you can search for the name of a package, a common package that's like consistent across a bunch of distros. And it lists many of the popular distros and tells you the version number that's currently published in that release of that distro. So for example, for SIFT, you look down the list and there's a whole bunch of different distros, and there's little red colours, backgrounds on the releases that are older than the current release, because Repology knows what the upstream GitHub repo has, and then green backgrounds on the releases that are up to date. So we put out 1.9.0, and anything below 1.9.0 was red, and anything that had 1.9.0 was green. And I thought, I wonder what happens if someone offers to update one of those packages. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go and see what happens. And I picked a few distros and had a look. And the three that I saw that were outdated on the day that we'd released the software, or the day after we'd released the software, the first one I looked at was Void Linux. And I think Void is notable for not using systemd and having their own init system. I don't know which one it is. I did use it at some point, but I can't remember. And I thought, I wonder how straightforward it is to provide a patch, because their packages are all in GitHub, the package definitions. So I thought, I'll just go in there, go and find the SIFT one. And if I look at the changes that other people have made to this package, I can figure out what I need to do. And there's only two lines you need to change, because it's just a minor update. And the only two things I needed to do was change the version number and the checksum, because it's a new package. The checksum will have changed. And I thought, well, I could do that, but what I really should probably do is build it and run it on Void Linux to make sure that I've done it correctly. So I went through reading the contributing guide, and I then spun up a VM. Enter QuickEMU. On my ARM Mac, I ran QuickEMU. Actually, I run quickget void, and then whatever the latest version of Void Linux was, and it span up a command line x86 emulator running x86 Void Linux on my ARM Mac.
You're welcome.
Now, it's an M3 Pro, so it's quite fast, and it's my work machine, right? So that's why I was using that, because it was my work machine. I was doing work stuff. And I had to install some tools. I had to get familiar with their package manager, because I didn't know it. It's completely alien to me. I haven't used it before. And I had to learn the build tools, and I had to clone and follow all the process. And I built the software and I ran it and I made sure it worked and it was all great. And then I submitted my pull request into GitHub. And I let it free into GitHub so that the maintainer or whoever was going to look at it could pick that up and merge it or not, or, you know, tell me I've done something wrong, or if I had, because it's quite likely I'd done something wrong because this was new to me. And while I had read the contributor's guide, I hadn't contributed to this distro before, and it was a lot of new stuff that I wasn't aware of. And so I did. I contributed, and then a little while later, while that was sat there baking, I didn't ping anyone or anything. I just left it there in GitHub. I thought to myself, that was like a drive-by two-line patch that I just did to that package in order to bump the version. What would have happened if it hadn't been on GitHub? What if their repo was somewhere else? Would I have felt as empowered to just join in? And so I thought, well, I'll go and find another one. So I found another distro, and I contributed the same update to a completely different distro that did not use GitHub.
Ah, okay. So I was just going to ask, did you feel empowered because it was GitHub, or was it the familiarity of GitHub that made you feel like an easy start?
That's why I was questioning myself, because I thought, you know, everyone says like GitHub, it's like the central place where all the software is and, you know, the network effects that people will do a drive-by. I picked a different distro. I thought, well, let's challenge that and see what happens. So I picked Alpine, and I've never used Alpine either. And so again, I built a VM on my Mac using QuickEMU. And so I was using the latest version of Alpine x86 on an ARM Mac, and it was fine. It wasn't the fastest, obviously, because it's doing some emulation in there, but it worked. And I built Sift for Alpine, the latest release, and I contributed a patch, but they've got their GitLab instance. And so it looks close enough. I had to create an account because I've never contributed there before. And I had to put my SSH key in there and all that stuff that I would already have in GitHub, right? So it would have been easier on GitHub, but it wasn't that much harder on GitLab. It was just a couple of extra steps and it was pretty straightforward. I knew what to do. So I contributed that to Alpine and it got merged pretty soon afterwards. Someone spotted it and they said, I had that on my to-do list. Thanks for the PR. And they merged it. And then the Void one did not get merged. And there's two reasons why. I was unaware that actually a lot of Void is done with bots. And so it looks like a person is updating something, but it's actually, a bot running under their name. And lots of different people have packages that they, in inverted commas, own or are responsible for, or they're the maintainer for. And if I'd have just left the Void one alone, probably a couple of days later, their bot would have run. And in fact, it did. And the person just said, I didn't see your PR, sorry. And they just closed my PR and updated using their bot or whatever script that they've got. So there's a lesson learned there. I should have gone and found, I didn't actually realize that that was a bot that was doing it. And once I dug and I found all the logs of the bots, I could see what was going on. But, you know, I didn't spend a huge amount of time getting myself into their community or trying too much to ingratiate myself with these people. I just thought, well, I'll just like do a two-line patch. That's all it's going to take. But I think it was worthwhile because I learned a little bit about the packaging systems on those two distros. I've still got the VMs, so I could do more pull requests. Like, we have a whole bunch of other software that is also out of date on some of these distros, and I could do pull requests for those as well. And I wondered, people are quite tribal in the Linux world, and they'll contribute to the distro they run, but most people don't contribute to another distro that doesn't directly benefit themselves. Like, me contributing to Alpine doesn't help me at all. Contributing to Void doesn't help me at all because I don't run either of them. And I wondered how many people out there who do contribute to distros or contribute to any open source project, would you consider contributing to something you don't actually use?
I was just thinking about that question there. Have I ever contributed to anything that I don't use? I've always been motivated to contribute to things because I'm using it or I need a fix. You know, maybe I'm not using it directly. Maybe it's a library or a foundational component and there's an issue there and you end up contributing to it because some higher order thing, you know, needs a fix. But I don't think I've gone out of my way to contribute to anything that I don't use. I mean, I'll think on that and report back, but I don't think I ever have.
I would put it to you that there is still, because this is your company's software,
mm-hmm.
I would put it to you that even though it's not that you're using this, because people are using this and having your products available for free is kind of a, you know, a bit of a soft bit of promotion, there is still, you know, there's still a driver for you to go ahead and do this. You're not just packaging someone else's software that you've never run and in making sure it runs on a distro that you never run.
Right. And there is also the side benefit. I'm talking about it now and I wrote about it in my newsletter. And, yeah. you know, so there is a benefit to me, but I'm talking about not actually using the software. And I don't really use Alpine. I might use it by accident in a Docker VM somewhere, but I don't actively go out and use Alpine. And actually, I found the way to contribute to Alpine was actually very pleasant. And they had very nice tools to bump a release. You literally, they have a tool called a bump, and you just run a bump and then the name of the package and the version number, and it just goes and figures it all out, and it does everything for you and builds the package, and you're pretty much done. It's a really smooth experience, and the APK, I think it is, the package manager on Alpine, is a pleasant experience. And while it was a bit slow in a VM on, you know, a different CPU architecture, and it would have been faster if I had bare metal, and it would have probably been faster if I'd done x86 on x86 emulation for sure, or, you know, in the cloud or something, I felt like it was a worthy activity of me to have a play with this thing and understand how Alpine packages are built, because it's something that I didn't know before. It's widened my knowledge a little bit. And in the future, maybe I might package something for Alpine that's whole cloth, that is not something that side benefits me through my employer or, you know, talking about it on a podcast. I don't know, because now I know how easy it is and how straightforward and how good the tools are and how responsive the people are. I might actually be more inclined to do it.
I was in the kitchen the other day making dinner, and my partner came in and waved her phone at me and said, "I can't cast this to the telly, can I?" She was trying to do a yoga class using an app which she has on her Android phone. And I thought, oh, I don't know. So I had a look at her phone and tried to find any option to cast it to the telly and couldn't find anything. And then I thought, well, I plug my Steam Deck into the telly with a USB-C cable, and this phone has a USB-C port on the bottom. I wonder if I plug it in, maybe we'll get some sort of screen mirroring going on or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried it, and I was blown away to be presented with a full desktop Android experience on my telly.
I thought you were going to say you were blown away by Kelly Brock jumped out of the telly and did yoga or something like weird science from the past.
Not quite that. But no, so it basically presented on the telly a full Android desktop. The phone kept on doing its thing. And then you had the option of launching an app in desktop mode or in phone mode.
Huh.
And this is because she's got a Samsung phone and it has a system on it called Samsung Dex.
That's still a thing.
That's still a thing. I remember hearing of this in the dim and distant past, but I had no idea it still existed or that this was the form it now takes.
Interesting. I thought it had been killed off, but it's still alive and well.
Yeah, it's still alive and well.
Wow.
And yeah, it basically lets you launch stuff as basically as a normal desktop. You could, I didn't try it. It suggests that you can use other peripherals as well, but when you're in desktop mode, the phone essentially turns into a touchpad and gives you a mouse pointer
right.
that you can then move around, and you can have your apps in Windows. And in this case, we could just launch the yoga app and play the video, and away we went. And then the next question came along, oh, what about sound? Because it was playing out the tinny speaker on the phone. And so I had a look around and found sort of where you'd expect it, a volume icon on the desktop. So I clicked it and it said phone, and it said external device. So I clicked on that, and the sound started coming out of the telly.
So this was just the screen and audio that you've got going out over USB, well, USB-C essentially at the moment, right?
USB-C into a hub, and then an HDMI cable taking that into the TV.
Into a hub. Oh, okay, so if there was a mouse and keyboard in that hub, does it pick those up as input devices?
That was the understanding I had from the various little things that popped up as it sort of launched itself.
Wow.
I didn't actually try that out, but I have used mouse and keyboard on Android before and it all sort of worked as expected. Like I've done it where you've plugged them just into the phone and you've used them on the phone screen with a tiny little cursor that sort of zooms around.
You said Android desktop. It wasn't a Linux desktop in a container or anything with Linux apps. It was proper Android application icons running Android apps.
Yes.
In Windows or full screen or what?
Yes. So the apps that were on the phone, you could launch them on the desktop.
Right.
If you launched them on the desktop and then went into the app switcher on the phone, you could see the app was running. But if you selected it there, it said, this is running in desktop mode. Do you want to close it there and reopen it on the phone?
Wow.
So it was like it had two different graphical environments, but it was running the Android apps in both.
That's even more impressive. Yeah, it's great. Wow.
Yeah.
I realize like we're being amazed by this, but I feel like people are probably shouting at their podcast player and saying, this has been around for ages, you fools. Like 2016 and Meizu Pro running Ubuntu, you could do exactly this wirelessly.
Yeah. And the funny thing is we've had Samsung phones in the house for years. I just never thought. Because the thing is, I've got a Google Pixel, which is, you know, like the stock Android experience. And you plug that in and absolutely nothing happens.
Oh, huh.
So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, a third party, essentially Android provider, has this whole additional experience, but you don't really hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, I can see some use cases for it. Did your partner actually use it for the intended purpose, or were you just like agog with like all these icons and windows and stuff on the telly?
No, it did exactly what she wanted to do in that moment, which was she had this on her phone. She was in the living room, so she thought it would be easier if it's on the telly rather than me squinting at my phone. And we got it to work just like that.
Hmm.
Brilliant.
Neat.